Welcome to the Impact Equals podcast from British International Investment, where we explore the impact investment industry, what it is, why it matters, and how it's reshaping global business. In this episode, we're discussing the benefits of investing at the intersection of gender equity and climate resilience. Entrepreneurs, businesses, and investors in emerging economies are already successfully addressing it. And in this conversation recorded during London Climate Action Week, you'll hear a few examples of some of these initiatives. This is a fireside chat hosted at our offices between Laurie Kerr, the CEO of FinDev Canada, and Leslie Marsdorp, the CEO of British International Investment.
Great to see you, Leslie. I always love the opportunity, and thanks so much for the very kind introduction, Emily. I love to be with BII as the oldest DFI, although you wouldn't know it from looking at Leslie, the oldest DFI with 80 years of experience and the youngest DFI with only 8 years of experience. It's always such a pleasure to have sort of the two bookends of the ecosystem, if you will, together. So thanks so much.
It's part of the, I mean, it's especially good to have you here because, I mean, as all of you know, the 2X emerged way back in 2018, exactly the time when you were born. And it was also the time when Canada's again hosting the G7 now, as we all know. So it's been quite a journey, Laurie. It's, 7 years now. Tell us a little bit about sort of that journey, but you know, we'll come afterwards to what's next, because that's really what I'm interested in. I mean, 2X was really remarkable in the sense that there was a target set, you know, within year one already, the target was exceeded halfway, and then new targets were set. But how do you see, after you describe the journey, kind of the next phase?
Yeah, so it's so thanks for that recognition. It's really been an incredible journey on the gender lens investing front. And as Leslie mentioned, so in 2018, when FinDev Canada was born, not me, I'm a long time before that, but when FinDev Canada was born in 2018, what was known as the 2X Challenge was also born when Canada had the G7 presidency. And initially what that was the MDBs and the DFIs came together to challenge ourselves, how do we do more gender lens investing? And it was quickly realized, what does it actually mean to do gender lens investing? So we took up the mantle. We were the first chair of sort of the 2X Challenge organization at the time. And we produced a first reference framework for what does it mean to actually have a gender lens investment. And BII and a number of the other DFIs were active participants in that. And so that first sort of reference framework was produced in 2019. And that was the first level set globally, which has then evolved into really the global standard for gender lens investing. You'll see across many, many websites, not just in the MDB and the DFI space, but increasingly also in the private sector space, 2X qualified or 2X challenge. We've got pins that we wear very proudly, even though I'm not wearing mine today, oversight. But it's really the 2X Challenge turned into the 2X Collaborative, and now it's 2X Global, which is an independent organization. We were also on the inaugural board of that, which we passed off to BII just last year. But it's really created the standard for gender lens investing. That initial pledge that was made across the DFI community was $3 billion over 3 years. Wow, that sounds amazing, right? Over $30 billion of gender lens investing. So blew the $3 billion way out of the water with that first pledge. And then in 2020, there was a new pledge as the 2X sort of started to grow and expand, an invitation to private investors to become part of that community beyond the DFIs. And the pledge or the commitment is $20 billion over 2024 to 2027, and it's going very, very well. So it has set the global standard for gender lens investing, and there's lots more to come as it expands across different sectors.
I mean, what I like particularly about the 2X example is the fact that, you know, it really demonstrates in practice how DFIs can initiate, be the sort of creators and the designers of an initiative, which then, you know, becomes an industry standard and becomes a global sort of, gets globally recognized. I mean, one of the key necessary enabling factors really is having full government support. So, you know, UK, we've had, you know, a government that was very much committed to the gender equity landscape. You know, that the world has since changed sort of globally with a sort of shift in political sentiments. But as I said yesterday in another talk, you know, things never move in a straight line, right? You know, inclusion, might not be the sexiest of topics right now in some corporate sort of headquarters, but I believe that, you know, in the end, things revert to mean. And it's good to have some of our investee companies here. We've got HBL, a big systemically important bank in Pakistan, doing incredible work in the gender space. So there's a lot of specific examples that BII can point to how 2X has made a very material difference. But can you say something about kind of what's next? Now that we've, you know, used the DFIs as enablers to have systemic sort of market impact, because it's gone way beyond sort of kind of what's next? If you have to think about, is it just about scaling the ambition, or the how do you link it to the climate resilience agenda?
Yeah, so it's a really great question. And 2X Global, as sort of the independent sort of secretariat managing the 2X, they certainly have a growth plan and what have you. But I think from my perspective, I think setting that global benchmark that we all can gel around in terms of making quality gender-led investments, I think the expansion of it to new sectors, it focused on the early days more on intermediated types of interventions, but now moving into the real economy. And what does gender lens investing look like in the real economy? Of course, looking at greater pledges, but where I think that there's the most interesting opportunity is actually the mainstreaming and the intersection. So it's not we invest for climate, we invest for gender, but how do we invest for gender and climate, which is exactly our conversation today. They're not necessarily separate lenses through which we look, but you know, it's almost like a kaleidoscope that we put in front of us, that we're looking through several lenses at the same time to create holistic investments. Yeah. So to me, how we bring all of that together, and it's not an either or, but a yes and, I think is where the future is. And you talked a moment ago about the opportunity for development finance institutions to work within the ecosystem to sort of create opportunities. And one of the amazing opportunities that BII has been instrumental in has been ARIC, the Adaptation and Resilience Investors Collaborative. Could you share a little bit more about that and BII's
role?
Sure.
I mean, I think this is naturally way before my time, but let's give credit to the leadership of BII and the sort of teams. But way back, it's a good 5 years now, BII played a very leading role in creating the ARIC initiative, which is really about kind of bringing investors, well, firstly bringing DFIs together. Started out with 7 DFIs, has since sort of expanded to 14 partners. And I think the role that ARIC has played, in my view, is sort of at several levels. I think the first one is, you know, giving a huge amount of thought leadership in this space, right? Just to sort of, because as we know, the fundamental premise why this work is so important is because when you look at climate finance, it's really in the mitigation side, climate mitigation, where there's a commercial imperative, where there are revenue streams, where most of the climate finance in the world flows, 92% or something more than that, goes into climate mitigation. This is about building sort of, you know, renewable infrastructure and so on. And everybody would acknowledge that the critical gap in terms of the financing gap has been in the adaptation space. So when it comes to, I think that ARIC has done is really build a consensus around the importance of adaptation and resilience within climate finance. So there's been a sort of evolution of consensus, if you like, not just within the development finance community, but more broadly, that the nut that we have to crack, the area that we have to make significant progress in. And you will see from the agenda this week of all the multiple events that's happening here at London Climate Week, there's a massive focus on adaptation and resilience. It is indeed, in my view, the central theme that is emerging. You know, we have to find new approaches and ways. So what ARIC has done is kind of develop the toolkits, develop the metrics to kind of build investor confidence mm-hmm. around adaptation and resilience, because people just assume you can't make money there, the public sector must do it. Right. That has been the sort of accepted wisdom way back in 2020, 2021 and so on. Now it has changed.
And maybe just a quick follow-up on the sort of the building the toolkits. One of the opportunities and therefore challenges actually with adaptation and resilience is that, unlike mitigation, where there is sort of decades-long approaches to, you know, how do you count greenhouse gas emissions, in the adaptation and resilience space, it's a little bit more incipient and emergent. So how does ARIC deal with the opportunity to create that standard framework at the same time, you know, not making perfect be the enemy of good, the good to make that forward progress?
Yeah. I think like all initiatives, right, you start somewhere in like a spiral, you sort of develop over time. Eric is exactly in that domain. The first one is to showcase successful investments. We've got, you know, a whole range of investments, you know, from, you know, the bank in Pakistan sitting right in front to, you know, the biggest battery storage facility in South Africa, where, you know, more than 25% of the women in the construction of that project participated. You look at Mahindra, the big EV manufacturer, one of the largest automobile manufacturers in India, for example. They've got imaginative programs, which is part of BI as an investor in Mahindra, to empower women, because at every step of the value chain of the electric vehicle manufacturing and supply chain process, women have been included in a very deliberate fashion. The key, what Eric is trying to do now is to use those as examples, demonstrate the success and the impact, and then with the aim of reproducing. In other words, it's about showing other DFIs, it's about showing the market in general that these investments, gender smart investments, can be profitable, can be commercially viable, and contributes very importantly to the inclusive agenda. BII is kind of, our entire thesis is all about inclusion. So it's a necessary element of every investment decision that we make.
Excellent, excellent. And something that you made sort of spurred a thought in my mind. I'm sure many people here are familiar with Climate Investor One, right? And Climate Fund Managers, Andrew Johnstone from Climate Fund Managers, he shared sort of an anecdote after we went through kind of a gender journey with him and his team. He said that one of the things that FinDev Canada brought to the table for him was radical transparency and radical intentionality around gender. It was like one of the things he just had never thought about, or the team had never thought about. So it's been really wonderful to accompany them on their journey. We also have, you know, Tammy from Eco Enterprises, who's on the next panel. We're a huge fan. We're an investor in both the third fund and the fourth fund. And I won't take your thunder, because you've got a wonderful story to tell about working with women-owned and women-led SMEs in nature-based solutions in Latin America. But again, the additionality that we can provide to our clients who are actually doing the hard work on the ground is great, as well as Ilya from ETG, wherever he is, over here as well. In the adaptation space, we've been supporting them, the value of technical assistance, so providing some technical assistance to ETG to map their value chains. They want to become, by 2027, deforestation free in cocoa, in soy, in coffee. So really working with clients that that have, you know, really complex and important value chains in local communities to help them become more adaptive and resilient, again, by bringing that gender lens.
Tell me, how in your investment process, because I've seen you've also have a focus, for example, on natural capital, how are you able in your investment strategy to incorporate, I'm talking about natural capital in particular now, because it seems to me that there is a new kind of imperative for us now to integrate these new domains in climate through a gender lens. Is there something you can share about that?
Yeah. So again, it's sort of a journey, right? Like it's still in the nascent stages, but it's something that we're really trying to bring in house. We're just reviewing our climate change strategy, and I think we're officially the first DFI to include both climate and nature as official goals of our climate change strategy. Not to say that certainly the other members in the community, including BII, look at nature, but we're really trying to be intentional around it and putting it sort of at the corporate level as a goal. So what we're doing is we're really trying to incorporate it as part of, like, there's the environmental and social reviews that are more on the compliance side, but looking at also the risks and opportunities around nature. It's kind of the flip side of the coin to adaptation and resiliency. Nature is so intertwined. I mean, there's the data point that came out, I think, last year at this time of $5 trillion, dollars of GDP are more than half of GDP is dependent on nature. I mean, I think all of GDP is dependent on nature if we were really to take a hard look at it, so which makes it even more, exponentially important to include nature. So we're looking at a number of different ways, I think, in a similar way of how we deploy our resources. We're looking at, are there solutions on the ground to support nature, or are we investing in adaptation resilience also through nature? So we get back to, is it resiliency of, adaptation resiliency of, or adaptation resiliency through the private sector? And we're taking both of those approaches and how we're deploying.
The reason why I specifically ask about natural capital, because, you know, it has also been the neglected cousin, if you like, a bit like adaptation and resilience has been in the sort of climate finance debate. And in a lot of these activities around Climate Week is often, you know, conversation amongst, you know, the movement, if you like, talking about, you know, the existing challenges, barriers. But we have to confront the sort of what's next.
Yeah.
And natural capital, I believe, is going to be the next sort of frontier. There's a huge recognition amongst low-income countries of this massive asset that has not been monetized, whether it's the Congo and the rainforest in Congo, and whether it's, there's so many low-income countries that have not been able to, or the financial instruments have not been designed and created yet. And like 2X, like the green bonds that was created way back in 2006 by, you know, EIB and the World Bank, and today is an industry of over $1 trillion created by DFIs. DFIs have this, as I said at the beginning, this unique and special role because we represent patient capital. Mm-hmm. We can take a long-term approach. We have government, in your case, the Canadian government, in our case, UK government, supporting this effort. And I specifically highlight this because, you know, over the next few days, all of you will be participating, you know, to push the panelists on asking what are the thoughts around developing new approaches, new investment approaches on the nature side.
Well, and one of the new approaches in terms of nature that we're looking at, so Canada, sort of now we're hosting the G7 again, and so FinDev Canada is working on the G7 DFI work stream underneath that, and there's a number of different work streams. The overarching goal is thematic is private capital mobilization. There's a work stream on energy and infrastructure, one on critical minerals, and then one on sustainable food systems. So to your point about creating novel or new approaches incorporating nature, we're kind of taking a page from 2X, and we're saying, okay, we, given the climate crisis, given food security issues, all of, you know, the DFIs and many private investors want to invest in sustainable food systems. But what does that mean? Just like, what does Gender Lens invest in? What does it mean to invest in sustainable food systems? So we're actually creating, with the great support of BII and the other G7 DFIs, we're starting to sort of chip away at what does that framework look like? What does it mean to invest in sustainable food systems? And of course, nature is a very important part of all that whole calculus. So stay tuned, more will be coming out on that, hoping to launch some indicative pathways forward maybe at COP this year, and then certainly it'll be something that moves on into next year as well and beyond.
Excellent. You know, the biggest topic in development finance for the last decade has been about scale. You know, in 2015, when Addis Ababa Action Agenda was developed, which was the last time that the UN International Development Community met, we'll meet again in Seville in about a week's time. And the key theme that emerged was about the fact that, you know, we have limited public resources, even more so today because of the limited and contracting fiscal space. We've got to be able to find ways and financial approaches and instruments to be able to catalyze and attract the vast, $200 trillion of money within asset managers, pension funds, sovereign wealth funds, and so on. We're at the stage now where, you know, we're looking at sort of what are the new potential leverage points in which to succeed in that mobilization agenda. Is this issue around, you know, the becoming a more of a force multiplier and mobilizing? At the moment, we're still scaling some of these initiatives, like on nature and so on. But what are the specific ways in which FinDev Canada is looking in the immediate future now to on this mobilization efforts? We can crowd in significantly more resources.
Absolutely. So the private capital mobilization agenda is something that we've been looking at for a number of years. At last year's G7, then Prime Minister Trudeau announced $720 million in a concessional finance and TA envelope, $20 million for TA, but $700 million in concessional finance dollars for FinDev Canada. And one of the first, so we're deploying that both at sort of project level as well as at the platform level. So vehicles, funds designed to mobilize private capital at scale. And the first utilization or the first application of those resources is through a platform. I know that I've spoken about before, but we're just on the verge of finally closing it, is a Gaia platform. And very apropos for today's conversation, it's focused on adaptation. 70% of that fund is focused on adaptation. And so what is Gaia? It's a $1.5 billion blended finance platform. We've got Green Climate Fund money coming in, as well as FinDev Canada concessional money coming in, with the idea to mobilize institutional investors into the senior. It's opening up new channels of finance into adaptation and resilience investments in 25 emerging markets countries. So we're not only working with the private sector, but we're also working with sub-sovereigns, right? Again, going back to the point of maybe not all adaptation-specific investments have a revenue stream associated with them. That doesn't mean we can't provide private finance for public sector actors as well. So we're looking at approaching things in a different way, but how can we mobilize private capital in new ways to put more than the 2 to 4% of private investment that goes into adaptation currently. Yeah. So we're hoping that that'll be a blueprint, a replicable model that can be scaled not just in the adaptation and resilience space, but in other markets.
We're looking and hoping to deepen that the partnership between Fundiv and BII on this front as well. And the G7 is happening. The G7 is happening again. Is it something that you're particularly excited about the Canadian leadership of and is there something from the DFI community for the G7 that you think people here could get excited about?
Yeah, so I think there's a lot to be excited about. I think that the G7 is a huge, you know, it's a leadership opportunity for Canada, and it's a good news story for Canada. I mean, think 7 years ago when we had the G7, FinDev Canada was born. The 2X challenge was born. And now 7 years later, or 8 years later, you know, look at where we are. So it's a very exciting time. We've really solidified, thanks to some good hard work of Italy last year, this idea of a G7 work stream. And again, the sort of the three pillars, it's been an amazing amount of collaboration across the G7 DFIs. Again, BI has been really, you know, a part and parcel and an active participant in all of the different streams. But we're putting DFIs as bilateral institutions, I think, more firmly on the table. If I were to look at the broader ecosystem of development finance, we have the multilateral development banks, which are a key cornerstone of development and development finance and the whole MDB reform agenda. Yes, absolutely, that needs to continue, and lots of really good progress on that. The other leg of the stool is actually the bilateral DFI community. We are a powerful group. The European, the EDFI Association that FinDev Canada became an associate member of about a year ago. It's been an extraordinary community. So I think bringing the DFIs as bilateral sort of mechanisms of our own government together, we are a force to be reckoned with. I think that's fabulous. We all need to be scaled up. And I think the third leg of the stool is innovation. Like, how can we bring some of these really innovative approaches and testing and what have you to market, whether it's in the gender and adaptation and resilience space with an eye to mobilize even more private capital?
So I think one of the key issues really is about, you know, measuring for impact and in the adaptation and resilience space. We're going to hear, you know, during the course of this week, the you know, importance of scaling and setting new ambition. But in doing so, we need to concretize a set of standards and metrics that are globally accepted. I mean, I find that, you know, at the moment there is a proliferation of approaches. I mean, we've heard about blended finance, for example. There's just so many tools. We just published the report recently sort of on blended finance to kind of help the ecosystem. I feel that our institutions, you know, DFIs in general, but, you know, our institutions in particular have played a leadership role in kind of, you know, looking at market impact. I mean, whether it's 2X, whether it's ARIC, these have all not just been initiatives by our own institutions, but it's been about how do you shape the entire ecosystem. Mm-hmm. So we are leading sort of impact investors, but what do you think is kind of next for this in the impact space? I mean, do you think we'll there's another breakthrough coming?
Yeah, well, I think that there's probably breakthroughs coming, but I think there's also really good approaches that we have right now that need to be scaled and need to be more mainstreamed across. So we talked about 2X and how really the DFIs lead into that to make the global standard. Hopefully with the Sustainable Food Systems work under the G7, we'll come up with something similar to that. But there was a different approach taken to an initiative that I was involved with way before I came to FinDev Canada, which was an initiative that looked to provide coherency for investors in terms of what does sustainability look like in the context of infrastructure. And so some people may know of the FAST Infra label. So FAST stands for the Financing to Accelerate the Sustainable Transition in Infrastructure. It was sort of born out of the One Planet Lab under Macron. And so I was involved with it back in, 2017, 2018. The Global Infrastructure Basel actually runs the secretariat of it now, and Bloomberg is involved. But what we set out at that point in time was, you know, wanting to create infrastructure as an asset class, given sustainability and climate concerns. But what does sustainable infrastructure really mean? So at that time, we brought together, it was an initiative of I was at the Global Infrastructure Facility at the time, it was the World Bank, it was IFC, it was OECD, Climate Policy Initiative, and a couple of other members, and HSBC. And we actually brought together like more than 70 participants from the private sector. I co-chaired a working group with Macquarie to actually come up with, okay, and what does it mean? What does sustainable infrastructure actually mean? So what we did is we mapped and talk about like a number of different like taxonomies and standards and this and that and the other thing. It was all brought together into a coherent ordering around a number of different dimensions, so environmental, social, governance, and adaptation, to provide regularization around a common way of looking with optionality. It wasn't about inventing a new standard. It was about providing clarity to investors on what is sustainable infrastructure. Yeah. Now, again, it's gone forward. There's more than $5 billion of assets or CapEx that is being self-labeled right now. Yeah. And so I think an initiative like that has a really good future in providing a signal to the market about what is sustainable.
I agree wholeheartedly with you. I think this is a very good example. It's more demonstration of the kinds of interventions that are needed to scale. We can learn from the FASTA infra, because the idea behind FASTA infra, the way I understood it, was to create kind of a globally accepted or new asset class, basically, right? So that, let's say you are a big institutional investor and you do have a mandate to invest in climate or in climate-sensitive investments. If something is labeled and is kind of accepted that these are the standards around which, or there's a globally agreed set of standards, then you can, your investment committees can make a simple decision. We can allocate, you know, X hundred million or billion to FinDev because all of the investments are qualified under that sort of umbrella. If we over time can develop similar kind of approaches to adaptation and resilience, because the more bespoke a deal is, the less chances you have to scale it. And the problem with our transactions, you know, whether it is in BII, FinDev, all of us, we have of necessity, because the conditions are so unique. You know, an investment in HBL in Pakistan is not the same as investment bank in Tanzania, even though we also look at the gender component and a gender's smart lens when we do the investments. There's unique, there's context-specific, you know, sort of areas. But this example you've made of FAST Infra is a very important one, I think we should talk about during Climate Week, because there's a lesson we can extract from that to see how we can scale to different levels.
Yeah, absolutely. And then the role of capital markets as well, right? Like the thematic bond issuances and things like that is another whole area that has,
exactly
has grown
right.
and that provides that opportunity.
That is exactly right. Because it, at the heart of development finance, in my view, if you go back to 1944 when the system was really born, it was John Maynard Keynes was really the architect of the Bretton Woods system, who articulated, and if you read our archives, you will see, he said that we need to find market-based and capital markets-based solutions for the problems of development. What that means is that, you know, because they designed World Bank at the time with having a credit rating, they can raise billions of dollars through the debt capital markets by issuing bonds on the back of a very high credit rating, and then deploy those funds into infrastructure and into sustainable development. We need to find new ways of market-based solutions, again, 80 years later, because as we've heard from various government speakers over the last few days, there's limited fiscal space. There's not going to be billions of new money flowing into development. We've got to be more imaginative. FinDev, ourselves, EDFIs, all of us will have to look at the world through a lens of how can we do more with less?
Exactly.
How can we become more efficient? How can we optimize on our balance sheets? And in the climate, you know, adaptation and resilience space, there is not going to be, you know, large pools of dollars flowing in. We're going to have to come up with more innovative ideas, and some of them will have to involve capital market solutions. So thinking fresh around that issue is something that our institutions will also be looking at. So
Do you have any further questions?
Well, I was just going to actually ask you one maybe quick follow-up question on the theme of innovation. And BII has recently launched a really innovative process around the concessional finance resources that you're managing as well. And I think it's a really interesting way of approaching the market. So I'm sure people would love to hear about it.
I was very excited about this idea because it was announced just as I joined BII. You know, I like the idea that we are going into a sort of a laboratory mode of just, you know, thinking fresh about solutions, right? So we were allocated £100 million by the UK Prime Minister to use as a mobilization facility, right? We could simply have, you know, designed, you know, a couple of deals to utilize that in a concessional way and demonstrate a ratio, hopefully, of, you know, mobilization of 5-1 or even potentially higher. We could have done that ourselves very easily. However, BII decided to take an approach where we would invite from market players ideas. So we did a call for proposals and we received 32 of some of the largest institutions in the world writing and saying, we have some ideas, you know, these are different ways, these are potential new financial capital market instruments we could think around, where we can maximize the potential of this £100 million of concessional money. So we've now shortlisted the 32 proposals to the top five, and very soon we will make an announcement of the winning proposal. So this concept of kind of getting the private sector players in the room, it's not us talking amongst ourselves here as BFIs, but we sit in a room with the big, with the Schroders and the Mundis and the Prudentials, all of these large institutions who manage trillions of dollars. When you have them in the room, that's when the real conversations start, because then they will tell you in a granular level, what are the investment barriers? What are the obstacles why they can't invest in 1, 2, 3, 4 jurisdictions and so on? So as you embark on your mobilization journey, as we embark on our mobilization journey, there's a lot more that we can do together. Because as I said, for this week, the London Climate Week, it's all about lifting the scale and ambition. There's no retreat. I mean, with respect to climate, our governments are fully committed to doubling down and increasing the ambition. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much to our guests, Laurie Kerr and Leslie Marsdorp, for that insightful conversation. And if you'd like to find out more about this event or our other events during London Climate Action Week, there are links to recordings in the episode notes. Thanks for listening to this Impact Equals podcast. We'll see you soon.